Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome Mary Beth Egling to the show. She is the author of Tell Me What You Can Do. She provides a clear step-by-step method of managing whatever life throws our way. She is a community education instructor teaching various classes designed to help others get motivated and realize their dream of publishing their first book. She has also written two other books entitled Love Abouts and Messages from My Hands.
Welcome Mary Beth to the show.
Thank you, Nell. Good afternoon. It's great to be back.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you on. You've been a guest before, so everybody be sure and listen to some of the past shows because she's come on and talked about her other books as well. So what I'd like to do first is have everybody have your contact information, websites, or anything like that.
Sure. My website is www.mbegling.com. My email is mb@mbegling.com, and I always welcome telephone conversations over emails, and that number is 585-544-2106.
Wow. That's really great that you'd be willing to speak to people.
I actually prefer it.
Ah, I hear you. Now, you teach classes on how to write books, is that correct?
I do. I do a three-tier class, basically giving people some initial direction when they decide that they want to publish a book. And then when they choose the way they want to publish, we kind of go into that a little bit more in depth. And then I do some writing courses and some consulting, helping people get their work organized, basically whatever I can do to help facilitate somebody, as you said, publishing their first work.
Yes, and we've also done a a show on that in the past that everybody can check out, how to write your own book. Because there's a lot more to it than people realize.
You know, there is. But, Nell, too, since I've been teaching the class, 19 people have published a book.
Wow.
And I always tell prospective authors that it's not me. It's just the person getting the correct information and then running with it. So I give all the credit to those 19 people who stuck with it, who didn't give up and realized that they could do it, and now they're all published authors.
That's fantastic. So tell me how this book came to be.
Well, Tell Me What You Can Do is kind of a template for how I've led my life and attempted to raise my daughters. And when I realized how effective the approach of, I call it the governing concept of optimism, was in my life, and kind of applied it to work settings, to leadership settings, to my teaching, to my parenting, I saw with a great amount of success that it actually worked well, and I decided that it was probably a good idea to put it out there and maybe make it more accessible to people that I don't know or that I hadn't met yet.
Right. So what is it exactly? It's managing whatever life throws your way?
That's correct. It's basically what the title says, focusing on what you can do for whatever problem seems to be in front of you, whether it's a small problem or a particularly catastrophic one. The process works the same whether you're dealing with a stubbed toe or, you know, loss of a loved one.
So it's telling you how to manage the problems in a series of steps?
That is correct. And, you know, I write in the book that I really like a template, and I like to work from something predictable for me and my personality. That seems to work well. So basically what I did was just outline this series of steps that anybody can apply to any size problem with what I think is pretty high success level.
So why don't we go step by step and kind of give people the concept of what the steps are.
Certainly.
So do you want to start at the beginning of the book, which is try, right?
Absolutely. You know, about 20 years ago, I was still kind of formulating this approach that I kind of adopted to get me through every day, and I was at a dental seminar, and one of the speakers that was hired to help make the dentist more productive was looking for a volunteer from the audience, and I raised my hand because I was very bored. And I walked up to the podium, and he put a $5 bill on the podium, and he said, "Mary Beth, I want you to try and pick up that $5 bill." And I, of course, reached for the bill, and when I was just about to touch it, he batted my hand away. He said, "No, I didn't ask you to pick it up. I asked you to try." And everybody kind of laughed, and I chuckled because I didn't really know what he was getting at. So he said, "Well, I'm going to give you another chance." And he said, "Mary Beth, I want you to try and pick up that $5 bill." And when I reached for it again, he spectacularly batted my hand away, and he said, "No, I didn't ask you to do it. I asked you to try." And he asked me to sit down after that, and he proceeded to tell the people at the office that try means an action. It's an exercise in futility, and it doesn't really mean that you're going to get something done. And he suggested that we use other words like I will and I can in place of try. And after that, he called a short break, and I began to think about how much I used the word try in my vocabulary when I didn't really want to do something. I didn't think I was going to get it done, or I wanted someone else to think that I was going to. So I made a concerted effort to remove that word from my vocabulary, and all of a sudden, I started getting a lot more done. It was almost like one of those magical clarity moments that you receive in your life that really profoundly affects what happens with yourself and your interactions afterwards.
Wow, so it removes that cop-out of, "Well, I tried, what do you want me to
right.
do?"
That's right, I'll try and get there, or, you know,
yeah.
I'll try to get it done. When we say try, in my estimation, we're just building in an excuse. And removing try from one's vocabulary means you have to do one of two things. You have to say, "I will do it," or "I'm not going to do it," or "I'm not going to be able to do it." It forces you to make choices, but that's
right.
A very liberating way to lead your life, I believe.
A clear commitment one way or the other.
That is right, and how nice it would be if we all were able to make a clear commitment on whatever happens to come our way And I think a lot of times people try to do too much, less than try, but that's what the word is used in that way. And when it really comes down to it, we know in our hearts whether we can get something done
right.
or we're not going to be able to do it. We just don't want other people to know that.
So realistic expectations of what we can accomplish.
Exactly, exactly. Right there,
which is the foundation of it all.
It seems to be to me, logically, that's kind of what I use as the basis of you know, really the, expounding on the rest of the book.
Because some people feel bad about saying no. It's very difficult for them to do that. And yet, so they take it on and they're not able to do it. So to me, it's kinder to tell people the real answer than to have them set up expectations and you not be able to do it.
You know, I think you're right about that. And I also think, too, that inherently as people, we want to be helpful. We want to make other people's lives easier. We want people to be able to count on us to do things. And I think if you let somebody get through the initial disappointment of accepting the fact that you are not going to do something, I think they respect you more for it in the end. When
right.
If you say, I will try to do this, and then nothing ever ends up happening, for example.
Yeah, your word becomes more credible.
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, that kind of becomes self-perpetuating as well. And, of course, the more one is able to sort out those things that they are going to do and they aren't going to be able to do, it becomes very empowering, and you almost take complete responsibility for how you spend every minute of every day.
Yes, I can very much see that logic. So you've determined you are going to do something. Then
correct.
What do you do from there?
Well, I basically look at, you know, if you follow along in the chapters of the book, not so much doing something in as much as accepting anything that comes your way.
Okay.
One of the chapters I started with was It Is What It Is, which basically means accepting whatever reality is in front of you. Typically, it's not hard to accept nice things that happen to us. We have no trouble accepting wonderful happenings. But whenever there's a problem or a crisis or a situation we don't like, one of the first barriers that we tend to put in front of ourselves is not accepting it for what it is. And
right.
I think that's a critical point that many of us seem to lose the ability to work a problem or to problem solve.
Yes, to water it down or just, you know, kind of be in denial about it doesn't make the problem go away. It actually adds another step to it.
That's exactly right. And I know I think many times, I think that if we recognize a problem immediately, then we tell ourselves, well, we need to make some type of attempt to correct it. Where not recognizing the problem is the worst thing, because then no action is ever taken. I think
right.
I say in the book, you know, don't let yourself go down that famous river, because denial is the worst place you want to be. That always results in inaction when you don't accept a problem or a concern that you have immediately.
Right. And I know there's a lot of problems out there that people face where it's like they feel like they'll have to change their life dramatically in order to accept that. So it almost makes them not move. But the best thing is to deal with whatever's in front of you, even if you wish it was completely different.
That's true. And, you know, I think that one of the biggest blocks to managing whatever life throws at us is actually recognizing, this is something that I need to deal with,
right.
meaning it is what it is, instead of trying to soft-shoe it or rationalize it away or trying in our minds make it something that it really isn't.
So now one of the next sections is do not panic, which is a
yes.
big one, because a lot of people don't necessarily have strong problem-solving skills when it comes to the heavy stuff that comes out of nowhere.
Mm.
So how do you deal with panic?
Well, I think that I have to say officially, I don't know any human being, including myself, that is not guilty of a moment of panic when a really hard realization hits us. It's
right.
just human nature to say, oh, no, and automatically go down the road of, oh, no. So I think recognizing that that's going to happen and halting it at that moment is particularly important, because you almost can't not, that little tiny split second of mini panic sets in whenever something goes wrong, large or small. One of the things I write about in this chapter, Nell, is something that I call the innerverse, which means the inner universe of the body.
Okay.
And when human beings panic, a whole cascade of things happen inside the body that cause stress and cause anxiety and, you know, over a long period of time cause many health issues. Just an inordinate number of horrendous things happen in the body. So if we can seize ourselves at that initial stage of, oh, no, and then pull ourselves back from it, our innerverse also remains stable, and we can better be equipped to handle the problem-solving skills that would normally follow. If we allow ourselves to get into a state of panic in our innerverse, it becomes particularly difficult to try and pull ourselves back from it, because we're already feeling stress on a hormonal level and on a cellular level. So the farther we get into the panic mode, the harder it is to pull ourselves out of it. So best not to really put ourselves there to begin with. And that takes a lot of practice. That's probably the hardest thing
it does.
That I ask people to consider doing, you know, out of the whole book.
Well, panic is such a powerful thing. To learn how to do it definitely takes a while. But your brain can't actually function at its normal level when it's in a panic state. So you can't process all the rational information that you need to solve the problem in front of you.
You know, that's true. And I have a number of patients who have been soldiers. And one of the things that they have said to me pretty consistently is that, you know, being in a heightened state of awareness is not the same as panicking. When you're in a heightened state of awareness, your mind is clear, you're focused, you're recognizing a problem, and you begin to work towards solving it, where panic basically means paralysis. It means
right.
You don't move forward. It means you physically, because of what's happening in your innerverse, which comes out in your body, you can't move forward because you really are paralyzed.
Right. And then the adrenaline and everything else has made you toxic to be
exactly.
able to process stuff. So stay calm is the...
Stay calm. When you recognize that you do have a problem, if you've said to yourself, okay, you know, this is what it is, the next step is really getting yourself to, right after you have that first oh no feeling, to take a deep breath and say, okay, I'm going to stabilize my innerverse, and I've accepted this, and now I'm going to work on solving my problem.
Right. So first, before even thinking about the problem, get control of your body, your emotions, the adrenaline within it, and calm yourself down to where you'll be able to think through the problem.
That's very well put. That's exactly what the Do Not Panic chapter is about.
And breathing, how important is breathing in stopping panic?
Well, as soon as I keep referring to the oh no moment, but as soon as we have that oh no moment, it's really important to take a very deep breath and let it out very slowly, because taking that deep cleansing breath really does a lot to stabilize all of the things that are happening. I call it a cascade of miracles that happens in the body when we are moving toward panic or moving away from it. And a very deep cleansing breath just helps you, albeit for a moment, ground yourself and center yourself and focus your brain on solving the problem and not panicking about it.
So then once you've gotten yourself calmed down and you're willing to accept the problem for what it is, then where do you go from there?
Well, I usually, when I've gotten to this point, I usually remind myself that things are not always as they seem. That's another chapter in the book that follows Do Not Panic, because it's almost a way to ensure yourself when you're thinking, oh, no, and you've managed to not panic, to remind yourself that many times in life, things that initially seem terrible really don't
right.
turn out so bad after all.
Some of the best things that's happened to me in life were horrible to begin with. you know, like losing a job or different things like that, where I thought, oh my goodness, this is just horrible. And then because of that, it forced me to step up to things and reorganize them in my life in ways that I never would have if that didn't happen.
You know, I think when you use the analogy of the job, so many people have said, you know, I was so upset when I was fired or when I lost my job, but
yep.
It literally was the best thing that ever happened to me. And we've all heard people say things like that. Because it did force a shift in what people were doing, and it did turn out to be a good thing in disguise.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But when you're in the middle of it, it's hard to have that faith that it is going to be the best thing.
Well, I wrote about the story of the boy and the Zen master in the book.
Yeah, can you tell us about that one? I love that
Certainly.
Story.
Certainly. The boy and the Zen master. Once there was a boy. On his birthday, he got a horse. Everyone in the village said, "How wonderful." The Zen master said, "We'll see." Soon after, the boy fell off the horse and broke his leg. Everyone in the village said, "How terrible." The Zen master said, "We'll see." Soon after, a war broke out, and all the young men were conscripted to fight, but the boy didn't have to go because his leg was broken, and everyone in the village said, "How wonderful," and the Zen master said, "We'll see." So basically, that story must be thousands and thousands of years old, but it really does pretty much typify we don't know any event that we accept
Right.
what it is and don't panic about. We don't know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, everything has a chain reaction, and then that connects to other things going on in the world. So you don't know whether it's going to be good, bad, or a combination of. You just have to let all the facts come in. And that way you'll be able to solve the problem step by step. But when it first happens, you're not going to know all the answers out there of how it's going to be solved.
You're right, Nell. And the other thing I remind myself when I'm in a problem-solving mode is that the universe really only presents facts. They're not good facts. They're not bad facts. They
Right.
just are. And it's our interpretation of a fact in front of us that causes us to feel the way we do. So I almost take myself emotionally out of the situation in order to solve it, even though clearly I may be emotionally vested in a problem. But if I remind myself that this is a fact, and I really don't know if it's good or if it's bad, it does
Right.
seem to help me to also gain some clarity when I'm looking to solve any type of problem.
Is that what you mean by long-range awareness?
Long-range awareness, that's right. That helps. It's almost like, okay, I have to deal with this right at this moment. And many times problems are urgent. You can't put them off or solving them. But I also think about the fact that down the road, this may be a boon, this may be a burden, this may be something very neutral, but I don't know that, so I might as well continue to work through it, knowing that
Right.
this may actually work out.
Right. Now, one of my favorite chapters in the book is Do Not Plan Ahead for Emotions That Drain You.
Mm.
So can you tell me more about that and what you were thinking when you wrote it?
Let's see. Well, we have a tendency as people to always plan ahead, especially when we're planning ahead in terms of sorrow or in times of anger.
Yeah.
It's almost a natural reaction to when we see a fact, we recognize it for what it is, to say, I'm going to be really angry about, or I'm going to be disappointed, or I'm going to be depressed, I'm going to be upset, I'm going to be pissed off. People use those phrases all the time before they know if something is actually going to happen. And what that does when you use that type of language, it sets your body up and you feel that emotion, even if it's just for a tiny moment, you
Right.
feel the reaction in your body, and that causes stress in the body. And when the body is stressed, when the cells are stressed, when the systems are stressed, it's not really working from a moment of clarity. It's working from a great disadvantage in problem solving.
And you've also created an experience for yourself that was completely unnecessary.
That's right.
Why do you want to take that energy into your body if you don't know what's really going to happen?
You know, and I think that...
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that it's almost a way of our ego protecting ourselves. But
yeah.
in fact, it is not only not protecting us, it's actually making things a little bit harder for us to accept. There's a law of attraction in the universe I write about in this chapter, and it basically states that like forces attract same. If you use negative language, if you think negatively, the chances of having negativity drawn to you are increased. And
right.
Conversely, if you use positivity, if you think along the lines of more positive things and use vocabulary that is not negative, more of those things will have a tendency to come your way. I really believe that that is how the entire universe is governed.
And, I mean, people usually have some process of at first getting upset and then thinking it over and changing their vocabulary. But I think what you're talking about is even going to a more of a stand of being very careful of the words you use, because that tells your mind what's happening. If there's danger,
really
the fight and flight, it activates all that by the words that you choose. If you're stressed, your body's going to think that you're in danger.
Well, we've all heard of the parasympathetic nervous system, and basically that is what you just said, the fight or flight. And I use some examples in the book. One is, I will be very upset if Joanne doesn't do what I ask her to. I recommend
right.
a corollary would be, I will be happy when Joanne does what I ask her to. So it's just a matter of changing a few words that will facilitate that shift in the law of attraction. It seems like it's something that wouldn't be effective, but as you so aptly put, the whole body does experience what you talk about. Because
right.
your brain obviously had to precede what came out of your mouth.
Exactly. And not only that, it shifts the energy in your body, which shifts the way that you're presenting yourself to that person, which could actually affect what's going to happen. So a little shift makes a huge difference.
Well, and I think, you know, you just said something that reminded me of interactions that happen all the time.
Yep.
We're often faced with dealing with somebody who said something to us that we're maybe a little offended by.
Yep.
Now, the normal reaction with many people would be to overreact, to get difficult, to get pissy, to get snotty. But if you step back and just say, well, maybe it's not what I think, and take a more calm reaction, that also has a tendency to dictate how the rest of the interaction goes.
Yeah.
You know,
and sometimes
you
acting completely opposite than they expect changes the whole chain of events.
That's
yeah.
very true. And,
yeah,
you know, I'm sure many of us have seen it work both ways, where some
yep.
things fall apart completely, or they could have potentially been horrendous, but one person's action saved the entire situation.
Right. Because I think our bodies do react more to the energy and the body language that somebody is presenting to us than the words coming out of their mouth.
Well, before we could speak,
yeah.
we relied on all of those things you just mentioned.
Right. So when you first even enter a room, people have a thought that comes through their mind of what kind of mood you're in. What are you presenting to them? And I think that's just a safety mechanism we all have to watch for danger or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
women especially, when other women walk in the room or other people, we scan and know instantly whether somebody's in a good mood, bad mood, and those change the whole outcome of an entire room.
That's very true, especially if we're not aware of our reaction to our assessment of someone walking into a room, for example. That's
yeah.
a really good point.
I've seen that happen where it triggers people.
It does. Well, and how nice. And really, it may not seem like a problem or managing whatever life throws at you, but, you know, the example you just gave happens 50 times a day to everybody. We're constantly changing interactions and meeting somebody new or speaking with somebody or walking into a room. And, you know, I don't look at putting on a false smile relative to, like, if I'm having a particularly rough time with something, I
right.
don't look at doing my best to not make it everybody else's problem as being false. I look at it as really not making my problem everybody else's problem.
Right.
Because
exactly.
my negativity could affect somebody else's frame of mind, and that's an awful burden to put on somebody else.
Well, no, because we're all a part of the collective, and how we interact with each other creates an environment for all of us.
Well, this is pretty much what the Dalai Lama has said, and Mother Teresa, and Gandhi. If we all behave, for lack of a better phrase, lovingly toward one another, there wouldn't be anything other than that.
Right. True. So now you've spoken your chapter about removing yourself from victimhood. What is that about?
You know, when we have a problem, whether it's big or small, for some reason, human beings have a tendency to want to wallow in it for a little while. And I actually put a challenge out to anybody who reads my book. If you can explain this to me, I would love you to call me or send me an email, because I cannot figure out why human beings, for the most part, really do like to keep ourselves suspended in a state of feeling bad for ourselves. It doesn't really serve any purpose, and it keeps us stalled in solving our problem.
Right.
You know, I use the example of my daughter when she was little. Whenever she would be upset, I would go to calm her down. And just as she was about to calm down, she'd work really hard to catch her face in a mirror or some reflective surface and wince and cry again just so she could see herself be miserable. Now, she's outgrown that, obviously, but it reminds me of, you know, what we do as adults when we have some type of problem and we're wallowing in it, and somebody comes up and says, well, geez, all you have to do is this. We don't know, we don't always want to hear it. We really don't want people to solve our problems sometimes. And that also is one of the impediments to, you know, managing whatever life throws at you, is saying, okay, this is what's happening. I'm really not going to suspend myself in feeling bad for myself. I'm going to take this energy and I'm going to put it towards solving my problem.
Well, you know, you create what you're used to. And if you grew up in chaos, a lot of times you'll recreate that environment. Even if you really broke it down, you would realize that that's not what you want, but it's your comfort level of what your body energy is used to living in. So I think that keeps you suspended in things that are really unhealthy for you.
That's a good point. I believe you're right about that. And, of course, as you mentioned, it becomes self-perpetuating.
Right.
And there's also the sentiment of, you know, attention for something negative is better than no attention at all.
Absolutely.
You know, there are people, I mean, I probably have been guilty of before, where I had a problem and I just really wanted some sympathy from somebody.
Right.
And
sometimes you do just want to vent and just have somebody listen to what you went through. And that's fine.
I think so too, because you are, you know, basically you do have to let it go. You have to get rid of that pent up stress or negative feelings about what happened. But that's different than becoming a victim of your circumstances.
Right. And the language we use is so powerful. And I don't know why as a society we don't recognize that more. But it makes the whole difference in how our mind reacts to everything.
You know, Nell, I know that you and many of the listeners are very aware of the horrendous storm that hit the East Coast this past week. And, you know, one of the things that you said reminded me of something that I was talking to Michael about earlier. All of the newspaper headings and the news accounts were fear-based and anxiety-based.
Yes.
And
they
now,
do that all the time.
You know, warning people to do these things, you know, telling people it's coming, absolutely necessary. And if they hadn't done that, there would have been a lot more death and damage. But also, you know, choosing words that just continue to hold people in a state of fear or anxiety doesn't help anybody.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, people may feel that it sells newspapers or gets people to tune in, but I think that focusing more on this is what's happening, this is how you can prepare, these are the things you should be doing, without, it almost verges on being drama, the word choices that are used. And as you as you said, that reminded me of this. It just fosters and festers a negative place for people.
You know, one thing you talk about victimhood, I think about, like, what happens to us as children or early years stays with us and keeps us locked in a lot of times, say a heavy abuse or whatever it is. But then I think about animals, say like a deer or whatever, that's attacked by, say, a lion. That deer, once it runs away and it's free, it goes right back to its normal life it was in before it was ever attacked. And I wonder that mindset of just, I was under a threat and now I'm not. And so I go back to my normal life. But we're not programmed that way for some reason. We stay in that, even when the lion is gone, we still stay locked in that we're being pursued mindset.
That's a really interesting point. And you know, I think that memory can serve us well, or memory can serve us very poorly. Right. And I think that, you know, like if the deer were to remember, okay, this is where the lion usually hangs out, so I'm going to avoid that place.
That's
using memory positively. But, you know, going around for the rest of its life in fear is using memory negatively. So I think the fact that human beings have the ability to remember is probably one of our greatest assets and maybe our biggest flaws.
Right. We definitely stay locked in on memories too deep. And part of freeing ourselves as a society is to learn how not to be caged in by what's happened to us
so that we
don't lose the rest of our life stuck in remembering something that's no longer a threat.
Right. And using it sometimes, I think, as a reason to not be able to solve problems.
Right. Now, you say we're hardwired to succeed?
We absolutely are. I wrote a chapter that's very loosely summarizes a concept called neuroplasticity. And basically what it means is the brain's ability to organize and reorganize itself in response to anything that would happen to us. When you talked about childhood, we are systematized as children to maybe see the glasses half empty or see the glasses half full, or to know that life is great or life is terrible. And though early childhood is the best time to establish the more positive aspects of what I just mentioned, adult brains also can undergo changes in how we view the world. So neuroplasticity, which means basically what it sounds like, you know, being able to change the way our neurons and synapses work, which changes the way we may view things, is still able, adults are still able to do that. It takes a little bit of work, but we can retrain our brains to see the glasses half full and not half empty if we are one of those half empty people to begin with.
Yeah, I think the hardwiring of the brain is something that we need to take a deeper look in within our society, because there's a lot more we can control there, and if with understanding of how our logic is formed. And I think we kind of randomly gather knowledge, and the brain doesn't always know how to put it together. So I think it should be something we're more proactive about.
Can I read one of the paragraphs from that chapter to you?
Yeah, that would be great.
It says, our attitude and perception about an event and the language we choose to describe an experience directly influence future outcomes. Any direction in thinking, both positively or negatively, grows and strengthens connections between brain cells that influence effort and motivation. So simply stated, one who thinks positively will have more motivation than one who thinks negatively. The person who chooses to think positively will have drive and enthusiasm, and the negative person will be demotivated and without energy. Like always attracts same. And we all know people like this. Positive people have a tendency to, even when things are not so great, you just almost get whipped up in their energy about being able to get something done. And negative people feel like a drain on you, and you feel yourself almost being dragged down with them when that person has a strong presence in your life.
Oh,
and
so
I always
glad
love
you read that.
Well, I think it's an important part of it. Of course, I couldn't remember it verbatim, so I had to cheat and look at my book. But, you know, you think about what Henry Ford said, whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right. And it's one of my favorite quotes of all time, because it really is true.
And the way our mind forms logic is very interesting to me, the whole working of the mind, because it really isn't based on truth. It's just based on whatever you tell it to connect A, B, C, and D, even though it doesn't have to be logical conclusion. It just says, all right, you want that, A, B, okay. And that's why I think people's thought processes can be so dramatically different. And you look and go, like, how in the world can they come up with that thought process? But it's just all in the mapping of the brain, and that's how powerful it is.
You know, and jumping off of that, every step that we take to move in a positive direction increases the chances that more opportunities to continue on that trajectory present themselves. That's law of attraction in the universe also. That's how things work. So even if it's a smallest step toward choosing a positive approach to even something that seems horrendous, you have just increased your chances of things working out better than if you had done nothing or gone the other way. And it's hard for people to buy into and believe that. And, you know, when my oldest daughter was younger, I would say exactly what I just said to her. And she said, Mom, that's not possible. That's not the way the universe works. So it's hard for people to believe that that actually can happen. And I always tell people, well, if you don't believe it, what do you have to lose? Just for one time, take that approach.
Right.
And see what happens.
Yeah, so the universe and the universe, to me, are definitely connected and work in a kind of dance. Is that the way you perceive it?
I do, and I kind of picture, for lack of a better description, a giant barbell. And one end of the barbell is the universe, and the other end is the innerverse. And the connection between them symbolizes how we really are separate, but there is a connection from, you know, the universe to us and from us to the universe. And in my life, it's just undeniable, and I see it in other people's lives as well. And I think if some the non-believers could just wrap their head around the fact that we really are connected to so much bigger than ourselves right there, I think it's almost like you realize you have the universe behind you, and you're behind the universe.
Exactly. Now, so then you created a chapter to help us put all this together.
Yeah,
can you tell
us think
about
that? Sure, I just called it putting it all together. And, you know, in the beginning I spoke about liking to work from a template. I basically just set up a kind of a flow. You know, you tell yourself it is what it is. You don't panic. You know that things are not always as they seem. You remove yourself from victimhood as quickly as you're able to. You remember you're hardwired to succeed. And at that point, those five items that you go through in your head, now you're able to tell yourself what you can do. So those five little points, if you will, get you to the point where you can most successfully truly begin to solve whatever problem you happen to be focusing on at the moment.
So when you say, tell me what you can do, how does that actually play out in life?
It seems a little silly. For example, if you have a problem and you've done all of those five little steps, you've gotten to the point where you've secured your innerverse, you've accepted the fact that you have an issue, you don't really know if it's going to be, quote, good or, quote, bad, but you are accepting it. This is the point where you're really able to say out loud, tell me what you can do to yourself. And that does a number of things. It shows that you are heading down the problem-solving road. You have used positive language, and your body feels the positivity. And asking a question, even though it seems silly to ask yourself a question, the natural inclination is that an answer will follow. And, you know, you can do this to yourself and see what happens. If you say, you know, now you have a problem, then you say, okay, well, tell me what you can do. All of a sudden, one or two little things are going to pop into your head that will actually be a positive, possibly, solution to what you have going on at that moment. Now, you may think about what one of the things you came up with and realize that it maybe is not the best option, but then you tell yourself again, well, what else can I do? And if that's not going to work out, what else can I do? And that, to me, is the critical point of solving a problem. Instead of saying to yourself, geez, now I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this, your brain is not able to think of two things at once. You're either focusing on what you can do or focusing on what you can't do.
Right.
And there's no way to do it concurrently. It's not possible for the human brain to do that.
And, you know, I kind of look at my brain sometimes as, like, it stores all this information, and I have to be specific on what I want it to go and gather to bring
mm-hmm.
me. And if I muddy the waters, then it's going to muddy the information back. But when you're clear and you say, only show me the things I can do.
That's right.
And then you keep saying it. It keeps going deeper and deeper into whatever's in your mind to show you the possibility. So you really need to do it 3 or 4 different times, if not more, to have your brain access deeper and deeper levels of choices.
That's right. And many times with a problem, whether it's large or small, the solution doesn't always come up right away. But I guarantee you one way it's not going to come up is if you sit down and you say, I can't do all these things about it. First of all, you're spending energy on something that you cannot change.
Right.
So why would you spend energy there? Once you start thinking about all the things you can do, I call it the resolution gate. The resolution gate is open, and it stays open as long as you continue to ask yourself, what can I do? And I used to ask myself out loud. Now I kind of think about it in my head. And there are actually a few times where I'm alone and I'm working something and I'll even catch myself saying, okay, what can I do? And it's just if you can make that an automatic response, truly amazing things happen from that point forward.
And your brain will start presenting yourself with that kind of information first. If it realizes that's a priority to you, it will present that instead of the other.
And
you'll
the universe
actually have
sends
to
the
ask,
same.
You know, ask again for if, what can I do, because it no longer be presenting that to you.
That's right. And, you know, the same thing works whether you're asking yourself or where you're asking other people what you can do. You know, in the book I outline the fact that sometimes it's harder to ask yourself what you can do because it's so much easier to help other people solve their problems than it is sometimes to solve your own.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and I always tell people when they're starting to maybe embrace this process, if you don't really want to risk maybe being a success, try it on other people first and go to school on them and see that it actually does work. And then once you feel safe to apply it to your own life, go ahead, which is okay. Some people don't want to, you know, jump headlong into something that's particularly new. They need a little proof first. And there's nothing more proof positive than watching it work for somebody else.
Now, you said that there's always one more thing you can do.
You know, I believe that. And there's a movie that's, it was called We Were Soldiers, and it was fashioned after a book that was written by the same name. And there's a scene in the book and the movie where the drill sergeant is saying there's always one more thing you can do. And if you keep that in the back of your mind, say you've asked yourself, what can I do? And in 5 or 6 minutes, only a couple things have come to light, and it doesn't seem like there's anything else. Tell yourself there's always one more thing you can do. And again, it does exactly what you said. It keeps you looking deeper and deeper into your brain, into your problem-solving abilities, because the solution many times is not always readily apparent. Sometimes you have to keep yourself calm and keep yourself working the problem until it comes out. But it's in there. The solution to the problem is in there, and I do believe there's always one more thing you can do about anything.
And, you know, sometimes the biggest thing you can do is be willing to shift your mindset on what you thought existed.
That's right.
And when you do that, then new possibilities present itself.
That's very true.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No,
what I was going to say is there's the last chapter, the chapter I wrote after that is called When There's Truly Nothing Left to Do, because sometimes you ask yourself what you can do, you go through a pretty lengthy process of figuring out what all your options are, then you realize, there really is nothing I can do about this. And then I tell in the book, believe it or not, in an extremely rare event that there's nothing you can do, there's still one more thing you can do. And that is getting past it.
Right.
When you finally get to the point where you have worked every angle of the problem to manage something that's been thrown at you, the other option you have, which is still a choice, is you can choose to get past it.
Which is huge, because
it's probably just as big as do not.
Like that.
Right. Because when you get past something, when you recognize it, you realize that you cannot solve it, whatever that is, then taking the next step and saying, okay, I cannot, which, you know, seems counterintuitive, this problem will not be solved, then you have to accept it and work on accepting it, which is, as you said, is very difficult to do, and I think it's almost as hard to do as do not panic, because where panic happens in a moment, accepting some realities sometimes take years to do. But
yeah.
The sooner we can get ourselves to get past something, the healthier we're going to be, because we're not holding it onto it anymore.
Well, I've had a lot of things in my life happen that I could not make any sense of at the time why they were happening. And they turned out to save me years later.
Mm.
So sometimes you don't know what chain of events that one piece is going to be included in years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, sometimes it's just necessary to set the foundation and let
That's right.
sit there until you need it years down the road. So you don't know what the piece's real history is going to be until you've seen it play out.
That's true, or not play out, too. Now, sometimes,
yeah.
you know, we never get a resolution or an answer, and that's where getting past it seems to be the most helpful. And one of the women who read my book, she says, well, you know, I lost my husband 5 years ago, and I can't get past it. And she has a valid point, but, you know, we've all lost people we love and care about, and though there's nothing you can do to bring them back, accepting the fact that they're gone and moving forward in your life is much healthier than keeping yourself suspended in the state that you were when you got the news, when you had to deal with that difficult situation.
Right. Or incorporating that truth into a way that you can accept it so it doesn't keep you caged in.
Mm-hmm.
And you're able to find quality of life even
right.
with this being a truth. Whether you want it to be or not.
And even though people may not, you know, to use the death of a loved one as an extreme crisis
right.
in people's lives, even though you may not be able to get over it, you can get past it.
Yeah.
You're always going to feel the loss of the loved one, but you can also continue with your life and not make yourself stuck because of a loss that you're still experiencing.
So you had the best example in your book, and this is so interesting to me. Can you explain that more?
I have this chapter called The Best Example because it's the best example that I've ever been exposed to of Tell Me What You Can Do, and it's basically about the Apollo 13 mission. You know, we've all heard Houston, we have a problem. And
yes.
I was very young at the time when this incredible human drama was playing out, and I truly didn't understand exactly what had transpired. When I got older, I watched the movie Apollo 13, which was directed by Ron Howard, and I literally was amazed at the application of only focusing on what can be done to solve a problem, how it actually got the astronauts back alive. And whenever I'm feeling overwhelmed, whenever I'm feeling like whatever problem I'm supposed to be handling or crisis or situation is so great that I can't bear it, I always hold that problem up against what I call the best example. And it helps me put what's going on in my life in check and realize that anything I could possibly be having happen to me is not nearly as serious as what happened with these men in 1970 in April.
Exactly. Oh, I watched that movie this morning, and it was so good, especially after reading your book. Then it just made it even that much more interesting to me.
Well, I recommend that anybody who hasn't read the facts or seen the movie, I think that it's kind of nice to see the movie because it highlights the drama and certainly could never completely explain exactly what must have been happening
oh, yeah.
in those days. But I think it gives the listener a really good, at least a sense of how incredibly critical it was and how amazing that these people were able to focus on what they could do to solve the problem. And over and over and over again, you know, through the movie and you know, through the retelling of the actual events, what can be done is really what solved the problem at each juncture, not what couldn't be done.
Now, on page 80, I see where you have a quick reference flow chart. Can we run down that one more time just to pull it all together?
Certainly. I've designed this little, what I call a quick reference flow card, which was designed to be cut out of the book or copied and pasted up, because many times when we're trying to learn a new technique, it's nice to have some visual reminder. Basically, it is all of the main points in the book. It is what it is. Do not panic. Things are not always as they seem. Then you remove yourself from victimhood. Then you remember you're hardwired to succeed. At that point, you tell yourself what you can do. And then you remind yourself that there's always one more thing you can do. And if there's truly nothing more you can do, you compare your situation to the best example. And then you adjust your attitude and you get past it. Seems overly simple. It actually is hard to apply. But if people get in the habit of, you know, just running down the list when they're faced with maybe a small problem and see how it works out, that they might be willing to maybe apply it to some larger things that seem to go on in all of our lives.
Yeah, I definitely love all that you put out in this book. Have you written other books as well?
I have. I wrote Messages for My Hands, which is a book that addresses my redemption. Seems overly dramatic, but that's what it is. And then one of your favorites, Nell, Love About.
I do love that book.
Which is basically about the value of ending every day with an affirmation. And really, that theme of positivity is really kind of carried through into this book as well. You know, Love Abouts was more at the end of the day positivity, but this is just getting through the day positivity.
Right.
And it's funny, this book is selling a little better than Love Abouts did. And one of my friends says, why do you think that is? And I said, well, I think if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs and look at what humans seem to need, that getting through the day is more important than feeling good at the end of it. So that's the only thing I can come up with, that this has broader application in people's lives. I see value in both. But, you know, maybe that speaks to where our society is, as you said earlier in the show, that we have so much negativity, we have so many things pinging on us, we have so many demands, and it is starting to take a toll on us as a people, I believe.
I think so, too. We're just overwhelmed with all that's out there.
It's you know, I think we all feel it at one point or another, and I'm not saying, obviously, that I have all the answers. I'm just working to provide maybe a little way for people to get a handle on certain parts of their life that they can affect, and hopefully that's what this book has done and will do for people.
Yeah, this is more of a pocket reference book.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Because it's like, what is it, about 80 pages?
Yep, 80 or so pages, and actually I have some blank note pages at the end of the book for people to maybe journal and maybe to put some thoughts down, because sometimes it's harder for some of us than others to make that shift in our thinking. And one of the psychotherapists that I worked with for many years and who uses this book in her practice said that journaling about issues typically seems to help resolve them.
Yeah.
So, there's a number of blank note pages in the back for people to do just that, because sometimes trying to change the way we problem solve requires some self-reflection and some, you know, looking into maybe a little bit deeper than what might be happening in the surface in our heads or in our lives or in our families.
Now, did I read something about another book you're working on?
Yes, it's called Real Feminism, actually. So it's only in its initial stages. I don't even really have anything more than chapters drafted out. So I would love to be able to tell you that it is forthcoming quickly, but that's sadly not the case now. But I'll definitely keep you posted.
Now, do all these books end up coming because you teach the people how to write books, or is it just something outside of that?
No, I think that my teaching and working with people comes from the fact that I write books.
Okay.
My personality seems to want to be a sharing type of personality. When I published my first book, I know how great it felt, and I also know how many people have said I should write a book, and I thought, well, geez, if I can do it, why can't somebody else do it? So I think that my consulting and teaching came out of recognizing that I did it, and there's got to be other people that could do it, because I'm not exceptionally gifted, I'm not exceptionally intelligent, I'm not exceptionally fortunate. I just believe that if people are given the right information and then they take that and they motivate themselves, that they can accomplish exactly that. They can get their book done. They can get their work out there.
I completely agree with you. Now, can you say your website again and your contact information?
www.mbegling.com. And the email is mb@mbegling.com. And as I said in the beginning of the show, I welcome personal phone calls, 585-544-2106. I actually prefer conversation over emails. I know that's not necessarily the way things initially work in the business world or the personal world, but that's something that I will always return a phone call.
Oh, that is so wonderful to hear. Is there anything else that you would like to mention before we wrap up?
Well, I just want to compliment you because you, like many, many of us, have many things going on in our lives and not always pleasant things and not always easy to deal with. And you are like an eternal flame of positivity. And, you and I have got to know each other on Facebook and obviously
yeah.
through interviews. And I think when I sent the book to you, I wrote that this may seem intuitive to you because you're a woman of action. And I know that to be true from my conversations with you and from listening to your work and just from being exposed to you. So the only other thing I wanted to add is that you are a living example of how telling yourself what you can do works in somebody's life, because it clearly has worked in yours.
Oh, thank you so much. It's very kind of you to say.
It's true.
Now, I have a video at the end here that I'm going to play of Jim Lovell's story of what happened. So I think that's a great way to wrap up the show and give people an example of what they can do.
Absolutely. No, it's a great idea.
Thank you so much for coming on, and you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you, Nell.
All right.
It's definitely a gas of some sort.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
It must be the oxygen.
You see what I see?
Flight. Your heart rates are skyrocketing.
We have a 401 alarm.
That can't be real.
Man, it is fighting. Jack, what's the story here?
I keep losing radio signal.
That can't happen. It's got to be a
tragedy. And we got some serious time pressure here.
We're looking at less than 15 minutes of life support left.
It's like they're all over the place.
Damn, I'm losing it.
We never lost an American in space. We're sure as hell not going to lose one on my watch.
Ladies and gentlemen, the real Jim Lovell.
Thank you, Will. Thank you.
We took off from Cape Canaveral, April 11th, 1970, at 13:13 Central Standard Time. Right there, I should have known something was going to happen. We got ourselves into Earth orbit. We came around to the far side of the Earth. Of course, we checked out all of our spacecraft to make sure that everything was okay before we'd ever commit them to go to the moon, because once we got that velocity, we were on our way. But on the far side of the moon, we lit the engine the second time. Our third stage was still attached to us, and it gave us enough velocity and the proper course to go all the way, coasting all the way to the moon. This is my fourth flight into space. My second time to the moon, the stars, and the sights and the sounds, and even the smells were so familiar to me that we settled down for a very tranquil, a very lethargic three-day flight to the moon. And I was coming back down through the tunnel back into the mothership when suddenly there was a hiss bang. Spacecraft locked back and forth, noise all over, lights were coming on, jets were firing. I looked up at Fred Hayes to see if he knew what was causing all this commotion. And I could tell from his expression, he had absolutely no idea. Then I quickly looked at my third companion, a man by the name of Jack Swigert. Jack's eyes were as wide as saucers. Now things in the spacecraft began to happen rapidly. A light came on. Something is wrong with your electrical system. Before I could digest that piece of information, two more red lights blinked on. Two out of three of your fuel cells have just died. And very shortly, we'd be completely out of oxygen. And when that occurred, because we used oxygen to produce electricity, we lose the third fuel cell, and we lose all of our electrical power. And when that occurred, because we used electricity to control and gimbal our rocket engine, we lose the entire propulsion system. We were in serious, serious trouble. And that's when that old lead weight went down to the bottom of my stomach. You know that searing sensation you get when you're in deep trouble and don't quite know how to get out of it? You're not going to get home. I said, I already know that. Do you have a solution? I need a solution. They said, well, we have one. When you pass the moon and it slows you down and starts to aim you back down towards the Earth, as you pass the Earth, we'll have you light that lunar module engine again, and perhaps we can speed up your return home. I lit that landing engine. Normally that's what you're going to use to land on the moon. It worked fine. Moved us over to what we thought again, we were on that free return course. 2.5 hours after we passed the far side of the moon, we lit that landing engine a second time. Kept it on for 4.5 minutes as it pushed us faster, faster, faster on the way home. Then we turned it off. We have to hit the atmosphere coming back from the moon inside a 2-degree pie-shaped wedge with respect to the atmosphere. That wedge cannot be any less than 5.5 degrees, any greater than 7.5 degrees. We have to thread our way inside that wedge to make a safe landing. What this consisted of, and this procedure is in its entirety, for any of you who think that you might want to go to the moon, you might want to take notes, was for me to somehow manhandle the two spacecraft around. Didn't have an autopilot to help me, to try to get the Earth in the window of the lunar module. Now, you've all seen pictures of the Earth from space. You know the daylight, the nighttime, that line between the two we call twilight as it passes overhead on Earth. Out there, we call it the Terminator. In the window of my lunar module, I had a little crosshair, a little gun sight-like affair, normally used for rendezvous and docking. If I could somehow manhandle, just using the little jets without an autopilot to help me, to get that Earth in the window of the lunar module and then superimpose the horizontal line of my crosshair on the Earth's terminator, that then placed the engine in a position to either steepen up or shallow out the angle on the way home, depending on whether I had the Earth's daylight or nighttime at the top of my window, and if I lit the engine just to the right time. That was the entire procedure. I looked at Jack, and I tried to maneuver for some time. I finally got it where I thought it was, and I said, Jack, everything on this spacecraft now has stopped. Even the clock isn't running, but you do have a wristwatch. You tell me when to light the engine, and you tell me when to turn it off. He said, fine. I looked over at Fred Hayes, and Hayes was getting sick at the time. And I said, Fred, I know that when that engine comes on, without an autopilot to stabilize these vehicles, I'll never be able to keep the Earth in the window by myself. I'll take my maneuvering handle, and I'll keep the Earth from going up and down too much. You grab our backup handle, and you keep it from going sideways too much. He said, fine. On the side of my console, I had two buttons. One said start, the other one said stop. Direct electrical link between the battery and the engine. Normally that link is from the battery through the computer that really does all the work. It's the fourth astronaut, couldn't afford him. And I said, this is the way it's going to go. So at the proper time, Jack said start. I hit the start button. The engine came on. I jockeyed the Earth vertically. Fred jockeyed it horizontally. 14 seconds later, Jack said stop. I hit the stop button. And then, of course, we waited. We waited for the ground to track us to find out whether we got back up into that corridor to come back in and make a safe landing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I wouldn't have the pleasure to talk to you this morning if that was not true. I shouldn't be here to talk to you. 200,000 miles out, loss of oxygen, loss of all electrical power, can't use a propulsion system. Why am I here? I'm here because of a very dedicated crew, including the person who is supposed to talk to you here today, Gene Kranz, who use those attributes, those characteristics, good leadership and teamwork and perseverance, motivation, all these things to work on solutions to crises that they never anticipated, they never had planned for. That's the reason I'm here. I will leave you with an old saying that I heard. I think it's kind of apropos here. Maybe a lot of you have heard it. There are three types of people in this world. There are people who make things happen. There are people that watch things happen. And there are people that just wonder what happened. Back in 1970, in the control center, there were people that made things happen. And remember what Gene Kranz said? Failure is not an option. Thank you very much.